Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. When Piper Stryle failed to show up for work, a co-worker called her home. Piper's 3.5-year-old daughter, Shayna, answered and said, "A mean man carried mummy away." Then the line went dead. In the tranquil region of southeast South Dakota, word of the young mother who was brazenly abducted from her home in broad daylight shocked residents. Piper was the second woman to vanish, following the startling incident of a young woman who narrowly escaped abduction by fighting for her life on a dark and secluded highway. An intensive search by an elite team of investigators uncovered a secret crime location, but the discovery of a nightshirt cut in half, a burnt candle, and a homemade bondage board revealed the chilling truth behind the missing women. With the help of a quick-witted and streetwise maximum security prison inmate, prosecutor Larry Long and his team were able to piece together the sinister facts of the diabolical crimes. Best-selling authors Phil and Sandy Hammond, along with former Attorney General Larry Long, dive into the grim and demented world of Robert Leroy Anderson, a sexual sadist, rapist, and murderer. Duct Tape Killer is also the story of perseverance and proof that love will not be extinguished by the ruinous evil that seeks to take root in our world. The book that we're featuring this evening is Duct Tape Killer, the true inside story of sexual sadist and murderer Robert Leroy Anderson, with my special guest journalists and authors Phil Hammond and Sandy Hammond. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Phil and Sandy Hammond.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you very much once again for joining us for your brand new incredible true crime thriller here, Duct Tape Killer. Tell us how you both came to be involved with this. Who was the connection that gave you this incredible access to be able to write this Duct Tape Killer?
Well, Dan, when we were going around speaking about our other books, Gitche Girl and Gitche Girl Uncovered, we had many people come up to us and say, you should do a book on Robert Leroy Anderson. And often the name Larry Long came up. He prosecuted the case, in fact, spent every day for 2.5 years working on this case, and later became the South Dakota Attorney General. So we kept having requests to do a book, and we approached Judge Long, and he agreed to. We had some discussions because we had a lot of other people who wanted us to write their books, and we ended up doing this story with him.
Now, Phil, let's go to July 29th. 1996, and this Piper Stryle, She doesn't show up at work, and she's working at the Southeast Mental Health Outreach. And so tell us what happens just as a regular protocol when she doesn't show up for the disabled mother and son that she's working with and helping. So what happens, and what does the coworker do, and what does she encounter?
Well, Dan, Piper was very responsible, very diligent. She never missed work. 27 years old, former high school homecoming queen, just very dependable. So when she didn't show up to help this disabled mother and son, they called the mental health and disabled business where Piper worked. And immediately one of the coworkers didn't have good vibes. Immediately she thought a car accident or something, Piper would just not come to work. So the coworker gets on the phone and dials the Stryle residence. The phone rings and rings and rings. And finally a little voice answers, and it's Shayna. Piper's 3.5-year-old daughter. And the co-worker says, honey, is your mommy home? No. Is your daddy home? No. Is there a babysitter there? No. My mommy's going to die. And she hangs up the phone. Now the co-worker's really alarmed. She immediately calls right back. The phone rings and rings and rings. Shana finally answers again. And she said, I don't want mommy to die. I don't want daddy to die. A mean man carried mommy away. And the line goes dead again. And then, of course, following that disturbing call, authorities converge at the Striley home. And there's where McCook County Sheriff Gene Taylor, who's the first on the scene, and shortly after, Special Agent Jim Severson appears at the Striley home.
To give people a little visual of Sheriff Taylor, people in the community often compared him to Andy Taylor from the Andy Griffith Show. He was just so kind and so competent, and everybody loved him. He was the beloved sheriff in the town. So he's the first person to come across Shana.
And then, of go ahead.
But you write that he is not given the same information. He doesn't know anything except just that there's a child that is in welfare issue, and so he just goes there. He doesn't know about that phone call, does he?
No, they just told him to check on the welfare of little children at the home. They didn't give him any details. When he walked in, Shana says the same thing to him. She starts crying and says, my mommy's going to die. And Gene Taylor asks her, is your mommy in the hospital? Is she sick? No, a mean man in a black car carried mommy away. And she told us to run and hide. Shana's little brother had just turned 2 the day before. And then, of course, they get a hold of Vance Dryley, Piper's husband. He immediately comes home. And, of course, now Shana explodes with information for the investigators and her dad. He said, Dad, Daddy, a mean man carried mommy away. There was a loud noise, and he took Nathan's play tent. The day before, when Nathan, the little boy, turned 2, the parents gave him a little play tent, and that play tent becomes very important later on in this investigation. But Shana, the little girl, is just so focused that her little brother's birthday present had been taken by this mean man who carried her mother away. So that's where we're at this point.
Now, what does Vance remember after reconsidering when he talks to the detective, getting over this initial shock, obviously? What does he recall considering his daughter just had said?
Well, you know, he's pretty much in shock. He doesn't know what to think. They set up a roadblock. The Strileys lived in on an acreage outside of the city. And so there was gravel roads out there. They set up a roadblock and started stopping people that were going by and asking if they saw anything suspicious. The county road grader driver came by, and he said, yes, I saw something suspicious this morning. It was a black vehicle. It was a black Bronco, actually, black rims, black vehicle. And as it was driving towards me, it suddenly made a stop, went down in the ditch, made a U-turn, and sped off in the other direction. I thought it was very unusual. And so now with Shana saying a man in a black car took mommy away, the road grader driver saying that he saw a suspicious car turn around and roar away from him, and then Vance remembered the Friday before Piper went missing, the Strileys were running a Bible camp, Dan, for your listeners. They were very Christian people. They were running a day camp for daycare kids, and they even had wooden pews set up out for prayer service out in their front yard. And a man stopped in a black Bronco with black rims and came up to the door and wanted information about the Bible camp. But Vance remembered this guy was acting strange, like he was surprised to see a man answer the door. And he kind of fidgeted around, and then Vance remembered the guy's name.
And he remembered the man had said his name was Robert Anderson. And the reason is Vance knew someone by the same name. That's how he remembered his name. And so up to that point, they really had nothing to go on. They knew it was a black Bronco, and they ran a check on that through the Department of Motor Vehicles, but thousands of black Broncos came up throughout the state. So they just couldn't get a grip on anything. They had no clues to go by until Vance remembered that man's name. Then they could go ahead and run the name through the Department of Motor Vehicle along with the black Bronco. And again, Robert Anderson, it's such a common name. they still got lots of names.
And we can go on with this part of the story. We can switch gears, Dan, as we do in the book at this point.
Yes, go ahead.
The Mansky's.
Yes,
so,
introduce.
For your listeners, at this point in the book, for your listeners, we switch because you're going to find this is all going to become intertwined. We know what happened to Piper now. She disappeared. We know the investigators are trying to focus on a black vehicle, especially a black Bronco. But now we flash to the early 1990s. Bill and Larissa Domansky, along with their two daughters, had left the country of Ukraine. They were Christians also, and they were being persecuted in that country. So they wanted to come to the United States for religious freedom and a better life. And so they got jobs working at a local meatpacking plant. Good money, good jobs. And so their lives were really going in the right direction. But on the morning of August 27, 1994, Larissa fails to come home from work. Well, her husband, Bill, goes looking for her, and he finds her keys dangling in the driver's side door and a flattened tire on her vehicle. So now there's an extensive search for Larissa Domansky, a very young, pretty woman who had come to this country from the Ukraine with her family. And the extensive investigation, searched by multitudes of people in the community, it all goes cold.
And the name of the place where she worked is Morrell Meatpacking Plant. In the area, people call it Morrell's. It's very well known, and that will be important in a little bit here, too.
And that's where she disappeared from, the Morrell's parking lot. And then
there was
at
an
that point in the book, go ahead.
You talk about the once she disappears, the incredible search that Bill is involved with to look for her. Tell us about that.
Yes. He had a very close church. They were very dedicated. They spent their holiday weekend making flyers, bringing them around. They made up cards to bring to hunting stores because they knew that hunting season would be coming up. Hunters would be going through fields. They knocked on doors. They put up flyers. They, of course, there were search teams involved with this too, and they were looking all over the city. They even investigated the circus because the circus had been in town that weekend. They were searching for a needle in a haystack. They looked at everything they could. They even talked to psychics, yes, and looked for places where someone could have dumped a body. They were looking for places with easy access that were also hidden out of the way. And after a while, the case just went cold. They found nothing. They interviewed hundreds of people at Larissa's work. There's something like 3,000 employees who worked there. They narrowed it down to 100. They interviewed some of those people several times. They found nothing.
Now, this case goes cold, and you talk about Vance Striley leaving South Dakota at some point and interested in is a seminary and planned to be an ordained minister and lead a church someday. Tell us about Vance Striley and and how these two cases and these people intertwine, as you say.
Okay, so Vance and Piper actually met at Bible college. That was where they found each other. They both wanted to go into the ministry. Piper ended up going into education. Vance continued with the ministry. They had bought that piece of land that was out in the country, that acreage that we had talked about, because they wanted to start their own church. They started out with a Bible camp and a handful of people in their congregation. It was outside. They had an archery range, a swimming hole, some things like that to make it attractive to people. They had actually just purchased an old church, and they had the papers. They were going to sign that deed and take over this church, have it moved on to their land, and start a church together.
And then Piper goes missing, along with Larissa Domansky from the Morrell's parking lot.
Now,
so now the investigators are back at the Strileys.
But no one's put it together yet. They haven't connected the two cases yet.
Not quite yet. okay? But they, something is not right with this whole situation. The whole focus now is on this black vehicle. With the little girl seeing a black vehicle, the road grader saying he saw the suspicious black Bronco, Vance remembering a strange man coming by the name of Robert Anderson. So we go back to the Stryley residence on the day that Piper goes missing. It's nearly 3 o'clock in the morning now of the next day. The investigators are still out there. They run checks, and they get a name of a Ruth Anderson and a phone number. Well, one of the investigators very sneakily and slickly comes up with it's 3 in the morning. They're going to call and tell this Ruth Anderson a story and try to get some information out of her. So they ring the phone, and finally this groggy woman answers, and the investigator says, hey, I'm an over-the-road trucker. I hate to call at this time, but I'm looking to buy a car from a Robert Anderson. Are you related to him? And she said, that's my son, Robert Anderson, but he's working the night shift at the Morell's meat packing plant. And then things started to click with the investigators. Something had to be connected with these things.
When they heard Morell's, they immediately thought of Larissa Demansky disappearing 2 years before.
Okay.
Now, what do? They go to Morell's. They ask him for an interview. What is his response?
He agrees. He's very cocky, Dan. He voluntarily agrees to come down and be interviewed. No lawyer, no nothing.
And he plays this cat and mouse game with them. The part with his first interview is very interesting, but it's also very lengthy and involved. But to kind of sum it up, they figure that he had researched interrogation techniques because he would act like he was almost ready to tell them what happened. They said he would lead them up to the door and then he'd back away. He wouldn't tell them that last piece of information that they needed. He kept almost making himself guilty, and then he'd pull away. Sometimes he'd switch the topic, and he'd talk about black holes or how he was developing his own theory of light. And
science and all kinds of stuff like that.
Yes.
Sure. But at this point in the book, Dan, we introduced Special Agent Bob Grand Prix, who had extensive experience questioning sex offenders, and he got his crack at interviewing Anderson. He said right away he got bad vibes off this guy. The hair on the back of his neck stood up. He had enough experience to know this guy was off. So he gets Anderson to talk in third person. Well, Robert, if somebody would have kidnapped Piper, what would they do with her? And he said at that point Anderson perked up on the edge of his chair. A gleam went in his eyes, and he wanted to start talking about what somebody would have done to Piper had they abducted them. He starts talking about bizarre sex, and Grand Prix said you could tell the guy was getting stimulated by just talking about this stuff.
For Anderson, it was an obsession. When he was given the opportunity to talk, he couldn't resist. He literally couldn't resist.
When he's asked about the things that the police already know, you say that he likely read something about, a book about interrogation and the techniques used. What does he do and what does he admit to? And what does he not admit to in this, again, this wily conversation between he and police?
He won't admit to anything, Dan, but he talks in third person about Piper being probably taken as a sex slave or tied down and used for a bondage slave and all kinds of real bizarre things.
And then finally they asked him, was he ever out at Piper's? No, he'd driven by it. And then they came back, they let him paint himself in a corner a little bit, and they came back with, well, why would somebody tell us they saw you there? Oh, he remembered he had pulled in the driveway, but then it looked like there wasn't anybody home. He backed out. Then a little later they said, well, why would we find your fingerprints on the door? And I don't believe they had. And he said, oh, that's right, I knocked. Well, at that point, he put himself at the murder scene, and that's when they were able to get their warrants.
And so,
he finally made one mistake.
You talk about the warrants, but also they referred to a 94 DMV photo. And with that photo, they went to the two witnesses, Vance and Shayna. What was the result of them looking at this photo lineup from police?
Yeah, they took his driver's license and they got other driver's license with people that looked similar to Robert Anderson, and they showed it to Vance Striley and they showed it to little Shayna. They laid it out. But at that point, neither one of them could pick out Robert Anderson as the person that came to their house or the mean man that carried her mommy away.
Right.
And then during the interview, they started to think, you know, he doesn't really look like his driver's license photo anymore. His hair had started to recede, and he just looked different.
Yeah, so then they took a photograph of him, okay? But and then they showed that, the new photo lineup, to little Shayna, who did pick him out as the mean man that carried her mother away, and Vance identified him as the strange man that the Friday had come knocking on their door wanting information about the Bible camp.
And, of course, they showed it to them separately. And with Shayna, I think this is kind of ingenious. She's so young. They didn't show her a page of a photo lineup like they would to an adult. They had each picture individually, and they showed it to her one at a time like a deck of cards. And she picked out Anderson.
And then, you know, but he wouldn't give them anything, of course. And at this point, we also switched back again, because it was a situation on November night in 1994, just a few months after Larissa Domanski vanished from the Morell's parking lot. There was a pretty young woman, a businesswoman by the name of Amy Anderson, no relation to Robert Anderson, of course, and she was in town visiting a friend, and as she's driving back home to a small town about 15 miles outside of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a car is driving right on her bumper, her rear bumper. Headlights are right shining in her car. The car passes her, and it's two men in a vehicle, and they look at the two women, and then they go in front of them. They slow down. So Amy Anderson, on the dark road, pulls around and tries to pass that vehicle. The vehicle tailgates again and then goes around the two women for a second time and goes up over the hill. Now, as Amy Anderson continues to drive, all of a sudden she hits something in the road. A metallic thud clunks underneath her vehicle. Well, she takes her friend home a few miles later, drops her off, and then she's going to proceed back home. And as she's driving along, it's apparent that her tire is going flat. She's hit something that's made her tire go flat. She pulls over, and a minute or so later, sure enough, here comes that same car that had tailgated her when she was taking her friend home, pulls over. A man gets out. He's got a baseball cap on, a little bit of facial hair, and she assumes he's a good Samaritan, even though he tailgated her. And she says, "Thanks for stopping to help." And she opens the trunk to get in, and right when she's reaching into the trunk, the man grabs a hold of her and tries to drag her over and pull her into the vehicle. Well, this Amy Anderson struggles and fights and finally is able to break loose and sprints down the dark highway in sheer terror. And just thankfully, there's two young teenage girls who come up over the hill in the dark. Amy jumps up and down, waves her hands. She jumps in with these two teenage girls, and the two assailants that almost tried to snatch her on the road pull a U-turn and take off. She hears them say, "Let's get out of here." And so they feel now that this case possibly is connected as well, which it surely does turn out to be.
And Amy was so lucky. There are some pretty remote roads in that area, and at night you might go quite some time before somebody else comes along.
Yeah, just pure luck that two teenage kids happen to be driving up over the hill right when she's trying to escape being abducted.
Now let's get back to the search that's being conducted. Very interesting. While he is being interviewed, while Anderson is being interviewed, while he's not under arrest, they have the ability to get the search warrants. And with the search warrants come the searches of the various things that are important and end up being important in this case. So what do they get the search warrants for? And even in the preliminary search before the Bronco was sent to the state lab, what are some of the things that investigators are finding in that search? And where do they search?
Well, they were able to get search warrants for Robert Anderson's house, for his Bronco, and also to search him personally.
His body.
Search his body.
And in the Bronco, it ends up being full of suspicious items, Dan.
He's a pack rat.
Yeah, but for your listeners, they find some strange stuff in there. Duct tape that's been, you know, ripped off. They find ether and tear gas. They find receipts for washable paint and paintbrushes. In one of the toolboxes, the investigators started nicknaming that the torture box. They found eye bolts and chains and these long 9-inch wooden dowels. And the most disturbing find was they could tell there was a homemade bondage board that fit right in the back. The rear seats had been removed from that Bronco, and it was a 3/4-inch plywood board with eye rings in the corner. You could tell it was a bondage board, and it had indoor-outdoor carpet glued to it. And so they knew they had something bizarre. Now, back at the home.
And then in their home, they found, again, the home was just packed with stuff. They could hardly get through the hallway. But they did find on one pair of jeans a dark stain on the crotch, which would turn out to be important. And the reason that stain was there is when they searched Robert Anderson, they found out he didn't wear underwear. He never wore underwear. If he had, that stain wouldn't have been there, and we'll get to that later. They found huge rolls of duct tape. He really had a thing about duct tape. They found handcuff keys and strange, sharp metal objects. So it was a flat piece of metal that you could lay on something, and then a point sticking out of it.
That had been welded on.
Welded on, and they had no idea what that was for.
They didn't know if it was a homemade weapon, some kind of a bondage torture item, but they found these strange, sharp metal objects.
And then I'll go back to one thing that they found in his toolbox, and that was some plants. And they weren't dried. They were still they were green. And they thought, well, that could end up being something. But, you know, in any remote area, you have weeds and grasses and stuff all over. So what's the likelihood that it would really end up being something?
Yeah, they were hoping these chunks of vegetation that they found in the back of his Bronco might lead to a crime scene. They could find where this what the vegetation was and where it could be found.
In this interrogation, in this questioning, he's playing cat and mouse. But throughout this whole thing, there is a singular priority for investigators that are questioning.
Yeah.
What is that priority, and how do they customize what they're saying and doing in order to be able to fulfill that priority?
Well, first of all, Anderson was not under arrest. They didn't have anything to arrest him for, so therefore they didn't have to read him his Miranda rights. And as they went on in the interview, he eventually started saying, well, maybe I should have a lawyer, and I think I want to leave now. And they'd say, well, sure, you can leave, but I think you're going to want to know what we found out. They have ways of keeping him there. And so they did, but they knew that at some point a judge was going to rule that they couldn't use any more information that they got from Anderson. So here's their rock in the hard place.
But
they want Anderson. Yeah, they want Anderson to admit that he did it. But if he does admit that, it's going to be inadmissible. But that's not their priority. Their priority is thinking Piper could still be alive. And if they scare him off and they push too hard, he might leave. And depending on where he has Piper, you know, she could be in a small place. She could, you know, probably be confined. She can't get away. She could end up dying. And so their concern is they want to find Piper. They don't want to push too hard, but they want to push hard enough. So they give him an out and say, you know, where do you think somebody might take someone like Piper if they had her? They're trying to get him. And then they even say they have information that she's still alive. He just doesn't budge at all. He
but
won't give them
any
information.
They're really trying to push him over the top. Say, Robert, can you help us out with this?
Yeah. They're
you know,
so
saying things have maybe gone a little far. Can you help us find Piper? We think she's still alive. And their main priority is trying to find Piper. They think she might still be alive, and you've got her held captive somewhere.
And they're so worried. Her life is in their hands, and if they say the wrong thing or they don't say the right thing, she'll lose her chance, and they'll lose her.
But they have to let him go. They don't have enough to arrest him on. And so he goes off.
How do police proceed? They know they have their man, but they can't make the arrest. So obviously they're very anxious to be able to gather the evidence they need to be able to make an arrest. How do they proceed, and what's their first lead or break that helps them?
Well, if we say in the book, Dan, it's almost like even nature was trying to help nail this guy. The plant,
right.
Those pieces of vegetation were sent to the South Dakota State University lab, and a botanist was asked to identify them. And it turned out to be black snake root was one of the plants. And so they asked the botanist if he could go and maybe identify where this black snake root could be found.
He said it would only be in a place where there was shade and there wasn't cattle grazing. It would have to be undisturbed.
Yes, and so they get a helicopter, and they take this botanist, agrees to fly. He knows how important it is to try to find where this plant might have grown. So they fly him around out by the Lake Vermilion area, out by the Striley residence where that black bronco was seen. And the botanist said, no, this plant wouldn't grow anywhere around here. We need to go east of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, over by the river, the Big Sioux River. I think we might find an area that would be conducive there. So the helicopter goes back, and they start flying along the Big Sioux River that runs along South Dakota and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And the botanist says, hey, down there, that looks like an area where black snake root might be found. So the helicopter lands, and they start looking around. And the botanist says, yes, if it was me, I'd be looking in this area. So the investigators bring a bunch of volunteer police officers and off-duty investigators, and they start looking around this area where the botanist says I'd be looking. They find a chunk of duct tape, and they gather around it, and it's got some hairs attached to it. And that right away didn't set with them. There'd be no reason for any duct tape to be found in this area. Now, when Piper went missing, she was wearing a black and white striped nightshirt. They found a half of a black and white striped nightshirt near that duct tape. It had been cut down the middle and ripped off, and so the nightshirt had been cut in half. They have a roll, some chunks of duct tape. They found a burnt candle, and they found a battery-operated vibrator. So they had the secret crime location.
And this was all within a couple hundred yards of each other.
Yeah. So they knew they had it. And lo and behold, a citizen that was just the day that Piper went missing was driving down the highway, not too far from where the botanist told them to look, and they found the Piper's nightshirt cut in half. There's another half of a black and white striped shirt laying on the highway, and a citizen picks it up. He was just going to use it as a rag to clean his car. And lo and behold, it turns out to be the other half of Piper's shirt.
Which helps them figure out when she was abducted and where he took her.
You
also talk about that at that time they also searched with cadaver dogs and even brought in the famous NecroSearch institution to come and take a look to see if the body was on this property or anywhere near this vicinity. Didn't they?
Yes.
Right. And NecroSearch can find bodies that have been buried dozens of years ago. They can find bodies buried in the water, and it turned up nothing. They searched all over. They just couldn't find anything.
And they brought the National Guard out there. They went online. They spent tons and tons of time trying to find Piper's body.
They had citizen searches. They had people from all over the state who had rescue dogs bring them in. People on horseback looking through areas that are hard to get to on foot. They found a lot of unusual things, but nothing ended up being evidence.
So, and here's the deal. So, they found a couple human head hairs on the bondage board in the back of Anderson's Bronco. At this point, we'll tell the listeners, they've made the determination that Robert Leroy Anderson had painted his Bronco black with washable paint on the days that he abducted Piper and the day he came out to abduct Piper when Vance answered the door the Friday before. He got scared off by the husband being there. They've come to the conclusion, which they were correct, Anderson had painted his Bronco black with washable paint, and that's why his Bronco was blue. And not black. And they found two human hairs on his bondage board from the back of his Bronco, and forensics said it was Piper Striley. Now, Let's go to the red stain, the dark stain that was in the crotch of his underwear on the day that Piper went missing. She was menstruating, okay? And Anderson never wore underwear, so obviously Piper's blood was in his blue jeans after she had been obviously raped and murdered. Very disheartening.
Now with, right. Now, they also find the idea that he had a 9mm gun. Where do they get corroboration, despite him saying he didn't have a license or didn't have a handgun at all?
Where did they get that information? Well, they found, first of all, let's tell the listeners that they found a spent 9mm bullet casing in the Striley driveway. Okay?
Right.
That was right away, right when she disappeared.
Yes, right when she disappeared. And Shayna, the little girl, said a loud noise went off. And Mommy said for me to get Nathan and run and hide. That's when Robert Anderson had come to their house the morning to abduct Piper right out of her home.
But he denied having a handgun. He said never had used for one. But they interviewed two different people, someone from work and another person, who said one person had gone out target shooting with him. They went back to the place where they'd gone target shooting and found shells that matched the shell that they found in the Striley driveway. And then there was another person who said that he'd gone hunting with Anderson and
he had a handgun. He had a handgun.
But they could not find the handgun.
They could not find the handgun. They could not find any other, so they didn't have a body. We've got no body for Larissa Domanski, who's disappeared from the Morrell parking lot. We have no body for Piper Striley.
But a lot of circumstantial evidence, and circumstantial evidence is usable.
But not really for a murder. They didn't.
Right.
The authorities decided that they didn't want to go after this guy for murder. They didn't have a body. They thought he could maybe get acquitted.
And they might find the body later on, and then because of the double jeopardy, they wouldn't be able to try him. So they try him just for kidnapping.
And so now here, former Attorney General Larry Long comes into the scene, who helped advise on this book for us. He is part of the prosecution team to go after Anderson for kidnap. First-degree kidnap is what they're going after him for, because they can get a life sentence on that.
And when Larry Long and the team got the binder on this, there was not much evidence in it. Some of the evidence we've been talking about is what Larry Long and his team gathered. They're the ones who sent in the hair to get it analyzed. They sent in the genes to get it analyzed.
And that's why we can tell you that the hairs were Piper Striley, and the blood on the crotch of his blue jeans were Piper Striley's blood.
The most incredible
Most incredible
testimony is yet to come, though, from anyone, from witnesses.
Right.
How did we come to find out about Glenn Walker, and tell us about the relationship between Anderson and Walker and how far it went back?
So now we're involved in a kidnap trial. And Anderson had tried to get some childhood friends involved in abducting and raping women with him. One of his friends outright turned him down. He kept trying to talk his friend into it. This friend kept turning him down. He had another friend by the name of Glenn Walker. Well, Glenn Walker, eventually, it was the dominant personality over the weaker personality. Glenn Walker eventually gets involved in this thing. Now, at this point, Larry Long, the prosecutor, the investigators don't really know how Glenn Walker's involved. But while Robert Leroy Anderson is standing trial for the kidnap, Glenn Walker calls a coworker and leaves a voice message on the tape recording phone message machine and says, we need to tell the authorities that Robert Anderson was out looking for a new church for his family to go to. That way it'll take away some of the premeditation for this kidnap trial. So the authorities knew that this Glenn Walker was involved somehow, but they didn't know how. They didn't know how deep he was involved. So they used a trick on Glenn Walker. They subpoenaed him and made him come to the kidnap trial. Now, Larry Long told us we really didn't have any intention of getting Glenn Walker up on the stands because we didn't know where he fit into this picture. But,
right,
Dan, they were trying to make Glenn Walker nervous, make him come and sit every day at the trial. Every day, am I going to get called up? And put this pressure on him. And by gosh, it worked.
during the kidnap trial, Glenn Walker approached the Attorney General, Mark Barnett, who was on the case, and said, if I can get some kind of immunity, I will tell you and show you where Larissa Domanski, who disappeared from Morrell's, is buried. Well, the authorities said, yes, we're interested in this, Glenn. We'd like to know where Larissa's body is, but right now we have to finish this kidnap trial, okay? I want you to talk to somebody else and deal with them and try to show them where this body is, and we're going to finish this kidnap trial, and then we'll deal with you. So the kidnap trial goes on. Now, one of the interesting things for your listeners, Dan, is Shayna. She was 3.5 years old. She's now turned 4.
Yeah.
She is an eyewitness to her mother getting abducted. There was a big legal debate between Larry Long, the prosecutors, and the defense attorneys for Robert Lee Anderson. Should a 4-year-old little girl testify? Is she old enough to either understand her, you know, the oath that she has to take? Is she going to be reliable? The defense attorneys were very concerned. They said, it is our right to cross-examine that little girl. And people aren't going to like us when we cross-examine her. We're going to take her every which way but loose. You know how this goes. We don't want this little girl to testify. Well, the judge determines that she is old enough to understand the oath. She will testify about her mother's kidnapper, and she will be allowed to be cross-examined by the defense. So everybody's on pins and needles on how Shayna is going to do at the kidnap trial. Is she going to be able to tell about the mean man that carried her mommy away during this trial? And it's just the most heart-wrenching thing.
But before we tell you about that, at the same time, let's jump back to Glenn Walker, because this is going on at the same time. And the relationship between Glenn Walker and Anderson is interesting. They're codependent. They met each other in elementary school. Glenn Walker was quiet. He was shy. He was awkward. He kind of struggled. He needed Robert Anderson because Anderson was smart and smooth and suave, and he could tell people to go wherever he wanted to tell them to go. And Anderson needed Walker because he could control Walker, and he needed someone to control. So that had been their relationship since elementary school. Walker said, I did the heavy lifting and Anderson did the thinking. And that came to be true in the trials as well. So while all of this is going on with Shayna, also Glenn Walker, they send Glenn Walker to talk to another authority, and they say to Glenn, well, what do you need immunity from? You know, you say you know where Larissa's body is. What do you need immunity from? And Glenn says, well, I know where her body is buried. And this investigator is very smart. He says, that's not a crime. You can know where somebody is buried.
Yeah, Robert told me where he buried Larissa.
Yeah, so we'd like to know where she is, but you don't need immunity. Well, in this back-and-forth conversation, Glenn Walker thinks he has immunity, but the authorities did not grant him immunity.
He never signed any immunity papers. Mm-hmm. Glenn Walker ends up leading the authorities to Larissa Domanski's grave and never got any immunity for it.
But there's a surprise when they go to her grave. She is not there.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Honey. You know that Honey is the free online shopping tool that automatically finds the best promo codes and applies them to your cart. And you know how great it feels to save. But how does it feel to save with Honey? Well, saving with Honey feels like finishing up hitting every green light on your commute. I bought the book we are discussing tonight by Phil and Sandy Hammond, Duct Tape Killer, in paperback form. It was listed for $13.99. I got it for $12.49, $10% savings, just like that. I'm always excited to save money with Honey because I know that I will save money on every single purchase I make. It's that simple. Did you know Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, including Macy's, Target, Sephora, Best Buy, and more, and they're adding more every day? Using Honey feels pretty great. Think of it as a little daily victory. Plus, it's free to use and installs in just a few seconds. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/murder. That's joinhoney.com/murder. Now, Phil and Sandy, we talked about Glenn Walker and his importance to this story and him being duped along with his attorney into saying far more than he needed to say. We just spoke about him thinking he had a deal for immunity, but he doesn't. But the one interesting thing is that this Leroy Anderson, Robert Leroy Anderson, doesn't trust anyone. And so what does he do in terms of that grave to thwart any kind of potential snitching from Glenn Walker?
What Glenn Walker didn't know is about a year prior to Robert Leroy being arrested for the abduction of Piper, Robert Anderson doesn't trust Walker. In the dark of night, he goes back out to Larissa's grave and digs up her skeletal remains, hacks them apart with a shovel, puts them in a bag, puts them in his car seat. He takes the skull, breaks all the teeth out of it so there won't be any dental records, and he goes scattering Larissa's bones all over the countryside, throwing them in lakes, rivers, in deep wooded ravines. He throws her remains all over the place. So now when authorities go back to uncover her grave, they're wondering why they only found a couple small bone fragments and a few pieces of cloth that looked like pieces of blue jean. Now they're wondering, you know, how animals couldn't have spread this body that far and completely got rid of it. So they're kind of
mystified.
Yeah, they're mystified at what happened to her. Well, unknown to the authorities, Robert Anderson had gone back. But, of course, he couldn't get rid of every piece of her body. There was some bone fragments that were left there. So now the authorities have some bone fragments from the grave that Glenn Walker said Robert Anderson killed Larissa Domanski when he snatched her from the Morrell's parking lot. This is where he buried her. And the bone fragments are now sent to the forensic lab for DNA testing while the kidnap trial is going on. I think we probably want to finish just a little bit about Shayna for your listeners. It's kind of interesting. On the day that Shayna was to testify at the kidnap trial, now they didn't have Shayna testify in the courtroom. They didn't want her to see Robert Leroy Anderson. So they took Shayna to a room at the local library, and they set up cameras that the people back at the courtroom, Robert Leroy Anderson and his attorneys, could see Shayna, and the spectators could see Shayna. And they had a female attorney question her, and a judge was at the library.
It was someone Shayna had experienced with,
yes.
Someone she knew.
Yes, and so Shayna had been working with a child psychiatrist because of the trauma that she had suffered by seeing her mom carried away. So Shayna had a security blanket that she had with her anytime people were questioning her, talking to her. And if Shayna felt like she was getting too upset, she could cover herself with this blanket, and then everybody knew that she didn't want to talk anymore. So the female attorney lays out the photo lineup again and says, "Honey, can you show me the mean man that took your mommy?" And Shayna sits there and she shook her head no, and she tried again, and Shayna grabbed her little blanket and pulled it up over her head and laid down and curled up in the fetal position. And at that point,
she just slowly pulled this little comfort blanket that she had. She pulled it around her tighter
and tighter
and tighter. And everyone in the room could just see her little body laying there. And it brought everyone to tears.
But Larry Long was ready to go. On the day Piper went missing and she didn't show up for work, her husband Vance called home thinking she was running late for work. And the Strileys had an answering machine at their house, a phone recording machine. Mm-hmm. And when the phone rang, Shayna picked it up, just like she did when the coworker had called. But Vance didn't hear her pick up the phone. So he hung up, but the recorder kept playing. And that recording was played for everybody in the courtroom during the kidnap trial. And Shayna's voice is heard saying on the tape recorder, "Daddy, Daddy, please call back." And then you can hear a whisper, "Oh, I hope he calls back. Daddy, 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 please call back." And so they did get to hear her voice during that trial. And it turned the jury to the prosecution. And Robert Leroy Anderson is found guilty of kidnap and is eventually sentenced to a life sentence in prison.
And that's where things get interesting.
Yeah, now the book really starts getting interesting.
Now, you talk about Larry Long and the other prosecutors. What is their goal now in terms of, obviously they want to charge him for murder and prosecute him for murder, but kidnapping without a body was a long shot as it was. So how do they, what do they have to get together to be able to ensure that this guy can be prosecuted for murder?
In the process, Dan, of them pulling together the forensics on the grave that was ends up being Larissa Domanski's grave, Robert Leary Anderson is now locked up in maximum security prison. He's housed in the infamous ADSEG, Administrative Segregation Wing, which is a prison within a prison. Only the worst of the worst are housed there and people that are on death row. Well, Anderson, because he was a notorious high-profile criminal, was housed in ADSEG. He ends up being cellmates with a man by the name of Jeremy Bruner. Now, Jeremy Bruner is cunning. He spent most of his life in lockup from the time he was a teenager. This cocky Robert Leroy Anderson is now, he's out of his league. He's out of his element in prison. He's never been there. And he's got a 22-year-old roommate by the name of Jeremy Bruner, who is sharp. He knows his way around, and he is going to slick, and he's going to con Anderson into revealing all of Anderson's dark truths.
So it's such a mismatch. Jeremy Bruner practically grew up in the penal system, although he's only 22. He's one of those people who, almost like in Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter, he can look at somebody and tell all about them. He was that kind of person. He could read people so well. And Robert Anderson had not a clue about how the prison system worked. And so you have those two people working against each other. It's no surprise who comes out on top.
And Bruner, Jeremy Bruner, had put the word out, which was not true, within the prison system, that he sidestepped and got out of a murder charge, a first-degree murder charge, in the state of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And Robert Leroy Anderson, now that he's a cellmate with him, is very interested in how did Jeremy Bruner beat a murder charge. And Bruner said, I pinned the evidence on somebody else. And Anderson said, do you think you could help me pin my crimes on somebody else? Now Bruner's got it. So Bruner starts, he takes his time, and he tells Anderson, okay, we can pin your crimes onto somebody else, but we need things. My brother on the outside will help with this. We'll find a guy that has no alibi, and we'll pin these murders of these women onto this guy.
But in order to do that, we're going to need evidence that you have from Piper and Larissa to plant somewhere.
Yes, we have to plant some hard evidence on this guy who has no alibi. Bruner calls him Mr. Ghost. We'll plant this evidence on Mr. Ghost. So, Robert, you need to tell us everything you know about these murders, everything the cops know, and even things that the cops don't know. And we need evidence to plant. Well, like all serial killers, Robert Leroy Anderson had taken souvenirs off Larissa Domanski and Piper Striley. He had saved them in his childhood bedroom up in the rafters in his mom's home, along with the 9mm handgun that he did fire in the Striley home and out in the driveway when he was carrying Piper away.
Now, Jeremy and Robert Anderson have several conversations because Jeremy is leading him on saying, I think I can help you, but I'm going to need to know this. Well, let me see. Let me talk to my sources. He doesn't come right out and say, yeah, no. I can help you. He's acting hard to get.
Yeah.
And so Anderson, bit by bit, and Jeremy knows that any criminal isn't going to tell everything at once. So he keeps getting more and more information from Anderson until he thinks he has enough to go to the authorities. And Bruner is torn because there's that criminal code. You're not supposed to snitch on anyone. But he feels like Anderson's crimes are so horrific that Anderson does not fall under that protective umbrella that criminals are supposed
like
to give
pedophile.
To each other.
Like a pedophile. Yeah. A pedophile is not going to be protected in a prison. And Bruner felt that he really wasn't going to be being a snitch because – What Robert Leroy Anderson did, he did it in front of little kids, and he left little children motherless. Bruner becomes kind of a likable guy in this book. Obviously, we can't tell you everything about him.
He is. For whatever he did, you can't help but like this guy. And Larry Long described him as being just as tall standing up as laying down. He weighed he
440 pounds.
Right.
But he was just hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bruner gets Anderson to tell him where his brother on the outside, or Bruner's brother, can go and get these pieces of jewelry that he took as souvenirs off Larissa and Piper, and the handcuffs, and we're gonna, and the 9mm pistol, and we're gonna plant it all onto this Mr. Ghost. We're gonna plant this stuff on him. We'll make this guy get arrested, and a good attorney should get you acquitted and get you out of prison.
But again, Jeremy's still kind of torn. He has to talk to some family members and say, should I be doing this? And they're saying, no, yes, this is a horrible crime. So he ends up going to someone at the prison and saying, I need to talk to the attorney general. And they kind of laugh at him. You know, prisoners go to, want somebody to talk to them every day. They know somebody did something, but usually there's no evidence to back it up. They say, go ahead.
Well, so Bruner said, I want to talk to the state, the attorney general, the state attorney general on this. And the person in the prison says, hey, look, Bruner, the state's attorney general is not going to hop down here just because you say you know something to get a murder conviction against Robert Lee Anderson. You have to give us something more than that. So Bruner says, okay.
Now a less experienced person would have just told everything they knew. But Jeremy thought for a minute, and he thought of the one piece of evidence he could tell them.
He tells the authorities, you think that Robert Lee Anderson took that little Nathan's play tent that day when he abducted Piper to wrap her body in. But you've got it wrong. When Anderson was struggling with Piper in the house, his 9mm went out. It shot a hole through that kid's play tent and shot a hole into the floor of that little kid's bedroom. If you go out there and you pull the carpet back, you're going to find a bullet hole in that little boy's bedroom. Okay? Now, after you go do that, you come back and talk to me. So the authorities went out there. They pulled the carpet back. They found a bullet hole, just as Jeremy Bruner described it. They inserted a rod to get the angle that it went through the floorboard of the house. It was actually a trailer house. They went underneath the trailer house, and with their bare hands, the authorities dug, and they found the 9mm slug that went through Nathan's bedroom floor when Anderson's gun went off and shot a hole through the tent.
Obviously, nobody would know that unless Anderson had confided in them. So the attorney general and Larry Long hop in a plane, and they come down to Sioux Falls
and
talk
strike,
to Bruner.
And they strike a deal with Jeremy Bruner, and they're going to give Jeremy Bruner a reduced sentence. He's going to get out of prison, but they want him to reveal where the 9mm handgun, the souvenir jewelry is, the handcuffs, and Bruner tells them. He draws a map, or Anderson drew a map to where the stuff was, and it was right in his childhood bedroom up in the rafters of the ceiling. Now they have the DNA evidence has come back from the bone fragments. Yes, it was Larissa Domanski. Glenn Walker says that Anderson murdered Larissa Domanski. They have the jewelry off the women, and they have Bruner to testify. Now they've got murder charges against Robert Leroy Anderson.
How do they proceed with that? And also, how do they come to learn about Jamie Hammer?
Jamie Hammer was the other, for your listeners, we said quite a while ago that Anderson had two childhood friends that he tried to get involved with abducting and raping women with him. One was Glenn Walker, who, by the way, did help abduct Larissa Domanski from the parking lot that night at Morrell's where she was working. Glenn Walker was involved in that. Jamie Hammer was Robert Anderson's other childhood friend that he grew up with. He kept trying to entice Jamie Hammer into getting involved, and Jamie Hammer kept telling him, no, I'm not going to do that.
Jamie adamantly refused. He
said, I'm not going to get involved in that stuff. And, you know, so they get Jamie Hammer to testify. Robert Leroy Anderson owned a vehicle, and his friend, childhood friend, bought it from him. And that car is what he put Larissa Domanski's body in when he took her out to bury her. And when Jamie Hammer bought the car, he told his friend, see that trunk right there? That's where Larissa Demansky's body was after I killed her and I took her out to bury her.
That was after Jamie had the car. Yeah. He was.
And so now Larry Long and the prosecutors, they have DNA evidence. They have Glenn Walker. They have Jamie Hammer, the other childhood friend's testimony. They have all the souvenir jewelry. They have the gun. They have the bullet slug that she went through the floorboard of the little boy's bedroom, ballistics matched it to the handgun that they found in Robert Leroy's childhood bedroom rafters up in the ceiling. They had all this stuff, and so now you've got a murder trial, first-degree murder trial with the death penalty attached.
He also explained the tire poppers as well and their role.
That's right. Jamie Hammer explained what those sharp objects were. That was Robert Leroy Anderson. One of his plans was to make these tire poppers, scope out pretty young girls, follow them, pass them up in a car, get ahead of them, stop, put one of these tire poppers in the road, flatten their tire, just like he did that Amy Anderson out on that dark highway that night when she had to fight for her life. And Jamie Hammer identified those tire poppers as what Robert Leroy Anderson was making and putting together to try to flatten women's tires so that he could snatch them. And now the mystery of those poppers, those sharp metal objects, he had several different designs for popping and disabling tires on women's vehicles. And he even told Jamie Hammer, I want you to get involved and we'll use walkie-talkies. One car will be down the road. One car will pass up a female, put the tire popper in her place, disable her vehicle, and then we'll both go and snatch her or we can take her off and rape her.
But Hammer was not interested in abducting anybody.
Nope. But he eventually got his childhood friend Glenn Walker involved. It's such a twisted case.
You talk about Bruner's testimony about Piper's demise at trial, too. So the horrific details are testified to at trial about what actually happened.
Yeah. Anderson told Bruner in graphic detail what he did to Larissa Demansky when he abducted her from the parking lot. Him and Glenn Walker abducted her from the parking lot at the Morrell's meatpacking plant. And he tells Bruner the details of Piper's death, too.
For dramatic purposes, what is brought into the courtroom for jurors to see?
Well, you know, a slew of evidence. The one of the things your listeners may find interesting is during the jury selection, you know, they wanted it's a real knack to pick the right kind of a jury that can come back and vote to kill somebody. So they were really taking a long, tedious amount of time. And Robert Anderson could not control himself. He legally could be present at the selection of the jury, but he would sit and stare at women and look them up and down and stare at their private parts, so much to the point where three women told the judge they don't care what happens to them. They refuse to go back in the same room with that man. He was just so perverse and so dangerous.
And they had all of the evidence. They had each piece of evidence in a bag laid out on a table. And at the end, they went through each piece of evidence, held it up, reminded everyone what it was for, the duct tape, everything else.
The tire popper.
And the tire poppers. And they saved the bondage board for the very end.
When they wheeled the bondage board in, you could have heard a pin drop in the courtroom.
It went silent. It just spoke for itself. It was almost like proof, just the fact that it was there.
Especially after Bruner had testified of how Piper died on that bondage board.
And now a little bit more about Bruner. He had a tough go. A lot of the inmates resented him for going to court on this. They threw urine at him. They threatened him. And he didn't care. He thought it was so wrong that Anderson had destroyed these two families, taken mothers away from children. He didn't care what he personally had to go through. He was going to give this testimony. In fact, when he was done, he talked to one of the parents of the women who died and let them know everything that Anderson had told. Answered all their questions. He did not have to do that.
He didn't have to do that. Another thing, I'll tell you something kind of interesting, your listeners, Dan, about Jeremy Bruner. He was just a character, too. The prosecution had spent all this time, they had the jury selected, and Bruner now has been brought in to testify a few days. And when they're in a side room during a recess during the trial, Bruner goes to the attorney general, one of the main prosecutors, and he said, "Hey, look, I think you're going to have a mistrial here. I'm a big drug dealer, and I see one of your jurors that you got sitting there. He's one of my clients. He's a big-time drug dealer, and he's a criminal himself. And I think this is going to be, as soon as that word gets out, this is going to be a mistrial."
The attorney general went red. He started to shake.
My gosh.
I mean, this would be a horrible thing.
And then Bruner let him sit on it for a second. Bruner said, "Nah, man, I'm just kidding you."
Yeah.
That's kind of Bruner's character. He was messing with the South Dakota attorney general, telling him he was going to have a mistrial after they put all this work in because one of the jurors was one of Bruner's clients.
You talked about John, well, we didn't mention him by name, but John Potts, the father, was banned from the courtroom. Tell us about this story. And the only, I guess, relief he got was he was able to talk to Bruner, and Bruner was able to answer questions that he had that, of course, he didn't get to see at the court. Tell us a little bit about John Potts.
Well, obviously, he was devastated. He'd lost his daughter. He was just devastated.
Well, and, you know, there was a lot of revenge. A lot of people hated Robert Leroy Anderson when word came out of what he did to those women, even around the community. I mean, they had to take a lot of security at the court trials. Well, Piper's dad, John Potts, her maiden name obviously was Potts. It was Piper Potts before she married Vance Striley. Piper's dad drives all the way up from Texas to attend every day of the trial, the kidnap trial. Now, remember, they're not going after the death sentence. They're only going after first-degree kidnap for life in prison. The prosecutors had to do that. They didn't have a body, even though everybody knew he murdered those women. Well, John Potts, Piper's dad, was extremely distraught and upset. He would sit in the witness or in the spectator section, and he would extend his arm and act as if he had an invisible pistol, and he would point it at Anderson and pull the trigger over and over on his invisible pistol. Well, the security guards were watching this pretty close at the trial. They thought that was pretty odd. Then the next day, John Potts comes in, and he sits by a window where the sunlight's coming in, and he pulls out a little handheld mirror, and he deflects the sunlight off the mirror into the eyes of Robert Anderson while he's sitting over there at his table with his attorneys. Now, the security guards go grab John Potts, Piper's dad, and they take him out. And they go get the prosecuting attorneys, and they tell him that he's been doing this stuff, pointing the invisible gun, reflecting light, sunlight into Robert Leroy Anderson's eyes. And the South Dakota Attorney General, Mark Barnett, says, "Look, what are you doing?" And John Potts says, "You guys aren't going after the death penalty. You're only going after kidnap and a prison sentence. You guys won't kill him. I'm going to kill this guy." And Mark Barnett, the attorney general, says, "Look, Mr. Potts, take it back right now. Tell me you did not mean that." And John Potts says, "I mean it. This guy's dead. You guys won't execute him. I'm going to kill this guy. He took my daughter. I'm going to kill him."
Can't blame him.
Which you can't blame him. I mean, he's just devastated. So now they go get the judge. And the judge gives him a chance. "You know, you got to say that you didn't mean this." And he says, "Nope, I'm telling you the same thing. You do what you got to do. I'm going to kill this guy." So Piper's dad, John Potts, is banned from attending the trial anymore. In fact, if he's going to stay in town, a criminal investigation agent would come and meet with him every morning and sit in the Continental breakfast area of his motel. And once they're seated, the agent would call. And that's when Robert Leroy Anderson would be transported from the county jail to the courthouse, now wearing a bulletproof vest every single day. And when the trial was ended for the day, John Potts, Piper's dad, would have to again be sitting in the Continental breakfast area of the motel with the agent, and then they would transport Robert Leroy Anderson back to the county jail till the next day's trial would go on. And that's how it happened. So now we come back again to Jeremy Bruner after the trial is all over, Jeremy Bruner did not have to do this, but he said, let me meet with Piper's dad, and I will tell him anything he wants to know that I said in the trial that he didn't get to hear. And John Potts did meet with Jeremy Bruner before he was taken back to prison, Jeremy Bruner, and he told John Potts everything he wanted to know. So it gives you a little bit about why Jeremy Bruner is a likable guy. He goes beyond just being a prison snitch. He's a pretty likable guy. And there's, of course, there's a lot more in the book that we can't go into, but Bruner becomes a pretty likable guy.
You talk about him being a likable guy, but also doing the right thing. But Larissa's husband, Bill Domansky, here's a guy that, tell us about this trip to Russia to get blood samples prior to the trial. Incredible story.
Right. Well, they had the bone fragments from Larissa, but they had no DNA from her or from the family. So Bill was already planning to go back to Russia. Well, they have a different, you know, medical system than we do here. So they said, Bill, you're going to have to learn to draw blood from her relatives so you can bring their blood back and we can have, right, from Larissa's mom and dad, so we can have, we can see what their DNA is, so we can show what her DNA is, so that we can show that these bone fragments are hers. So he goes back to Russia, he draws blood from her relatives, has to bring it back with him, otherwise they couldn't have proven that those bone fragments belonged to Larissa.
I mean, that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And your heart just breaks for Bill. I mean, he waited years thinking that she was being held somewhere. He held out that hope. He kind of got scammed by some people who said that they could.
He got scammed by some psychics that told him that she was being held captive against her will, that she was still alive. And Bill loved Larissa so much, he always hoped that she would just return. You know, as horrible as it is that to think that she'd being held captive somewhere, you know, it was better than thinking she was dead. But then when he saw Larissa's necklace that Robert Leroy Anderson took off her for a souvenir, and that then he realized, he broke down and he realized his wife was dead. It was a very heartbreaking situation at that point in the book.
There was, tell us about more about what was done at this death penalty case, because as you write, he wasn't given just any appointed lawyers. He was given a very, very reputable and high-profile team, and they fought hard in his defense. How did he accept or not accept that legal advice? And tell us a little bit more about this fight that they were unsuccessful, but they undertook
at court.
I'll let
Sandy answer that, yeah. I'll let Sandy answer that, but I want to say something that she might not think about. That is a different philosophy state to state down here in the United States. South Dakota just has the philosophy to give a first-degree death sentence case the best lawyers. Okay?
Right, because otherwise what happens is someone's found guilty, and then they say, well, I didn't have good lawyers, and then they go to trial again, and it's just drug out over and over. So they start a high-profile case with the best team they can find. So he had the A-team. He had a great team of lawyers. And then he's found guilty.
During the trial, one of the agents that worked with us for the book, he said he happened to be walking past a private room where Robert Leroy Anderson was in with his attorneys, and Robert Leroy Anderson is screaming and yelling at his attorneys, telling them how to do this and how to do that, and he thought... And this investigator said, you know, here's a guy that's got the best attorneys that money can buy, and he is so arrogant, he's screaming and yelling at these guys and telling them how to do their job at his trial.
And when the trial was over and he's found guilty, the first thing he does is start blaming his lawyers. They didn't pick the right jury. They weren't competent. He said, I demand that they find the bodies of these women so that it will prove that I'm not guilty.
Yeah, he just a total deviant creep, you know.
In the death penalty case, as you write, very much use the O.J. Simpson case as an example, very much like a civil case, another phase of a case, that being the other phase of a death penalty case, evidence that wouldn't be admissible in the trial part, in the penalty phase part, so we get to hear from Amy Anderson.
Yeah, now see, for your listeners, Amy Anderson that almost got abducted on that dark highway, she was not allowed to testify in the kidnap or the murder trial.
Because it wasn't directly related to Piper or Larissa.
Yeah, that would be hearsay.
Right.
You know, as crazy as the laws seem, her almost being abducted by somebody doesn't warrant that. But everybody knew it was connected. So when it comes time for the death penalty phase of the trial, now the rules change. Now the prosecution can present to the jury a whole bunch of other stuff to prove this guy is such an evil dude, he does deserve to die. You deserve to kill this person. The state deserves to put a needle in this guy's arm and kill him. So now they bring everything. They come blazing with both barrels. Now they bring in Amy Anderson, who tells about her terrifying experience on that dark highway and how lucky she was two young teenagers picked her up. And then the attorneys can say, see how this guy is? He's a serial rapist. He's a serial killer. And if he is allowed to live, he runs the risk of being this horrible person that continues this stuff. He could escape from prison. He could be released from prison sometime. He needs to die for what he did to Piper Striley, Larissa Domanski, and you can see he was ready to take other women.
Right. He actually had targeted a nurse at the prison that he wanted to try to abduct or kill or rape.
Yeah, I mean, while he's in prison, he tells Jeremy Bruner, I like the looks of the prison nurse. You know, when you and I get out of here, let's snatch her and take her and rape her and kill her.
Yeah, even in prison, people, with him in prison, people weren't safe.
Now, you talk about also about the deal with Glenn Walker. This deal with Glenn Walker. This is one of the most incredible parts of this is that the deal that they offer him and the polygraph that they ask him for. Tell us about this deal and what's the result.
Well, here's the thing. Glenn Walker never got immunity for showing where Larissa's grave was. Okay.
Right.
And they had Jeremy Bruner's testimony that Anderson had said that Glenn Walker was involved in helping snatch and abduct Larissa Domanski. So the prosecution wanted Glenn Walker to pay. Now, they couldn't nail murder on him. And they thought he could possibly get acquitted just because Jeremy Bruner didn't talk directly to Glenn Walker. Okay, he got some secondhand information from Anderson. So they offered Glenn Walker a deal. You can do this many years, was it?
20 years.
20 years. But we want you to take a polygraph test, and you have to clear out, which means you have to answer everything that we ask you on that lie detector test. And if you pass that, you only have your 20 years. But if you fail it, you get another 5 years added on your sentence. Well, Glenn Walker failed 2 polygraph tests. Were you involved in killing Larissa Domanski? No. Did you have sex with Larissa Domanski? No. It was all these different things. And the polygraph examiner said he's lying to some of this stuff.
So they said, well, he wasn't a good polygraph examiner. We want another one. So they bring in another polygraph examiner, and the exact same thing happens. So they said, Glenn, you weren't telling the truth. We're adding on 5 years.
He got a 25-year sentence, but in South Dakota, the state of South Dakota, at that time they had good time. So if he didn't get any write-ups or any trouble and all that kind of stuff. So he did, I think he did about 14 years, I believe.
Right.
I can't remember the exact amount. And
that's
then he got paroled, and then he left the state. He moved away. But Glenn Walker did he did do prison time for his part in these crimes.
Now, with Robert Leroy Anderson and his family, what is the, again, very interesting factoid about what happens with other people in his family regarding prison?
Well, you know, here's the thing for your listeners. People all want to know, what kind of a background did this guy have? Well, Robert Leroy Anderson there were three boys. He had two brothers and his dad. And at one time, Robert Leroy Anderson, both of his brothers and their father were locked up in prison all at the same time.
Not just jail, prison.
Yes, prison.
Yeah,
for various crimes. So you're talking a dysfunctional family. Now,
yeah.
One of the things of interest that we didn't even have in the book at this time, Dan, that we'll share with you, that wasn't in the book that you read, we had a person approach us that was a relative of Robert Leroy Anderson. And this relative wanted to stay anonymous, but she said, when you're going around speaking to all these groups, this is nothing new, but please remind anybody that are raising little boys to teach them to respect women and the value of females and the self-worth of females as they're growing up, to be polite, to compliment women, and to know that they are have great worth in this world. She said Robert Leroy Anderson and his brothers were taught that women had no part in this earth. They were to be degraded.
They had no value.
They had no value. And she said, that's part of the problem. And so she really wanted mothers and fathers that are raising little boys to know that they need to be raised to respect women. That's what this relative asked of us.
Despite the outcome of this trial with the death penalty and never get out of prison, what was his stance in terms of guilt or innocence after this?
He never admitted that he was guilty.
No, he said it wasn't him. He said he just had bad lawyer representation. And, now he's sitting on death row. He's in there for about 4 years, filing appeals, eating up taxpayers' money. And he never did admit to anything. And then
he will say he did not end up serving out his sentence.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Robert Leroy Anderson.
And his father also, previous to that, also committed suicide, didn't he?
Right. Yes, he did.
Yeah. So as your listeners will now know, Robert Leroy Anderson hung himself in his cell. And his father, his own father, committed suicide just prior to Robert Leroy Anderson. So, there's lots of interesting things about, obviously we can't go into great detail, but it's kind of interesting that Robert Leroy Anderson's dad commits suicide, and then very shortly after that, Robert Leroy Anderson commits suicide.
And you write that there was a complicated relationship that the two had, didn't they?
Right. They didn't have a good relationship, but Robert Leroy Anderson listed his favorite song as Cats in the Cradle, which is a song about a father who doesn't have time for his son. And then when the son grows up, then he doesn't have time for the father. So it's very telling of their relationship.
One of the things I'll tell your listeners is, as Sandy and I got involved in this project of writing this book about Robert Leroy Anderson, we kind of thought maybe he was operating on kind of a low intellectual level, but he was a very intelligent person. He was an engineering major. He was quite intelligent. And so that was how he was able to pull off some of these heinous crimes and get away with it for as long as he did, for as young as he was. He was only in his mid-20s.
Right. He dabbled in the stock market
in
high school. He took advanced classes. He was mathematically very smart.
Yeah, very intelligent guy. And, his college professor spoke very highly of his intelligence.
Because he came across as a likable guy. Like Ted Bundy, he put across one persona to the people he knew, but he was a completely different person.
Yeah, and we give examples of that throughout the book, too.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to be this one person, but then this other person.
He could fool everybody.
And just very complex.
Mm-hmm. You don't talk about what happens to Shayna in terms of a follow-up, but I guess everyone will be curious, because I think when you come away from reading this book, there is even before you see a photo of her, Shayna, you have an idea of who this girl is. It's just the most vivid part of this book is how you introduce her and the horror that she has just witnessed. What about Shayna today?
Right. Well, she is a very kind, caring person who serves her community, but the family also just wants some privacy at this point, so we didn't pull what happened to them afterwards much into the story. Other than that, they are very good people. Their mission in life is they're very godly people.
And we say that the family has the demand, both the Damansky and the Strawley families, obviously such a horrible, horrible situation. They stay pretty private about it. Larry Long has kept a pretty good relationship with both of the families. The prosecutor, Larry Long, who worked on this book, met with Bill Damansky, and, you know, the family's going to remain private, but they've all moved forward with their lives and have lived productive lives.
Right. Not moved on, but moved forward. Mm-hmm.
And like we say, when Piper and Larissa left this world, they left their children in good hands. Bill and Vance did a good job raising those kids. Let's put it that way. They went on to get college degrees, served their community. They're surrounded by children and their family photos, and it's a very strong, happy ending for people to move forward after such a horrible situation.
As happy as possible,
yes.
Put it that way.
Absolutely. It's a remarkable story, and as we did in the introduction, it is a story of perseverance and the due diligence from police and prosecutors. It's a remarkable story and a remarkable case where justice was served. I want to thank you both, Phil and Sandy Hammond, for coming on and talking about Duct Tape Killer, the true inside story of sexual sadist and murderer Robert Leroy Anderson. For people that might want to look at more information about this book, is there a Facebook page, website? Can you tell us more about how they might take a look?
Yes, on Facebook, Phil Hammond and Sandy Hammond, or the website, philhammondauthor.com, and it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And it will soon be available as an audiobook.
Oh, fantastic. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Duct Tape Killer. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. Congratulations on this book. It's fantastic. You have a great evening.
Dan, thank you.
Thank you very much for this interview.
Yep.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.